accession number 15448, reel 2.
Mr. Starkey, reel 2.
Thank you. Yes, we loaded these army warfare tanks in the New Westminster city, and we got supplies of such things as Arctic visors and extra Arctic clothing, and then it was quite a while before we were ready to go overseas, but we finally did set sail round about the 23rd of February, and we first there was the usual calls you made on the way to Lockyer and Reykjavik. We called it Methil, which was the port for Dundee, as you know. And then we went right round the north of Scotland to Lockyer, where some American ships joined the convoy. And then we sailed up to Reykjavik, as you know, the capital of Iceland. And Reykjavik harbour we formed up with further ships. Quite a number of them were American ships. And then eventually, it would be in early March, we set sail for Murmansk. We'd only left about 2 days sailing towards Murmansk, and the signal went up, convoy will turn 90 degrees, 800 hours, something like that. We turned 90 degrees, which is most unusual in the convoy. And a few minutes later, we got another sign, convoy will turn 90 degrees, the starboard it was. So in other words, we're heading back to Reykjavik. And we found out later that was because two marauding cruisers in the Norwegian bases they had there, the captain Norway. I think one was the Sjarnhorst and the other was the Gneisenau. They're the two well-known raiders of convoys in that area. But after quite a few hours, we did the same thing, turned 90 degrees to starboard, and a few minutes later did the same again. But this time we're going on a more northerly course. We're going further to the north of Norway than I assume our previous course was going to take us. I wasn't a navigator, so I don't know for sure. That was just my opinion. And all the convoy were doing the usual zigzag procedures, but there was no trouble with the steering on the New Westminster city. But as we got level with probably the northern tip of Norway, a very violent gale came upon us, and the ship, and there was driving rain and bad visibility, and the sea were running so much that the ship was pitching and we had difficulty controlling it, and it got so that the ships just couldn't maintain the convoy stations, and it meant that the more powerful ships, especially some of the Americans, they got on well ahead, whereas our ship, to do the regular 10 knot speed required for the ordinary merchant convoy, it was a difficulty for us to do it in normal conditions. And if we had a headwind against us coming from the north, it was impossible. So the convoy more or less broke up completely. And then we had a further problem because the wind has veered rather to northwest, and this was driving us towards the Norwegian coast, which would be very deadly rocky lee shore, like the old sailing ships are always wrecked on a lee shore. Well, and the seas, such as they were causing the ship to pitch so violently that the stern end was coming out of the water, and that meant that the propeller was racing. And the chief engineer, as they had in those days, he was complaining and said, if we get our engine racing like this, it could break down and we'd just be driven onto the Norwegian coast and lost. So eventually our navigating staff agreed to alter course slightly, more towards going back towards Reykjavik, And this meant eventually we'll be about a day's sailing behind the rest of the convoy. But at least it saved our engine breaking down. And then, as finer weather came, not such severe weather, we were able to resume our normal course towards Murmansk. And we probably made up a little bit of progress because the other ships wouldn't be doing the full 10 knots. And I could hear on the radio at night that some of the ships were already in the danger areas where they got the torpedoes and the bombs, this sort of bomb alley sort of thing. And about 2 in the morning, I received just a test message. You didn't usually transmit it much because the enemy could get a bearing with the direction fine, you see, and he just sent a very terse message. I think he sent an SOS front, and it, Harpalion, that was the ship, Harpalion bombed, that's all I got. Well, I passed that up to the bridge, of course. And as we were going well up towards the ice barrier, as we had to do. And then after a day or two, we did meet up with some other ships. And I found later, I wasn't always able to watch what was happening because I was on radio watching in case anything came important I had to listen to. But I noticed when I looked out that we were leading ships in line astern, and there was a destroyer and further down a corvette just in line with us, and we were breaking the ice. Sometimes you get a terrific shudder as the ship partly rolled up the ice and then broke it. And as I say, we were the leader for quite a while. And then keeping right up the ice barrier, we didn't, I don't think we did in the zigzag there because it's too hazardous to play around where were the ice, and we had to keep more or less a straight course. And we finally met up with some Russian ships at the mouth of the Kola River. As far as I can gather, the Russians only patrolled the Kola River. They didn't seem to come out much into the exciting areas. And we got through the Kola River to Murmansk Harbour. I was very dismayed as we sailed into Murmansk Harbour, really dismayed. I thought, you know, having survived all this, what I saw was ships and bits of ships sticking up in odd angles that had obviously been bombed and broken up. And I thought, well, this is no place for, if there's bombing going on here, it's no place for a ship loaded with gunpowder. It round about the 1st of April or the end of last day of March it was sailing to Murmansk Harbour.
What had the convoy been called? Did it have a PQ?
I'm not sure it was PQ-15. I think it was PQ-50. It may have been PQ-13. And if I remember right, the commandant was going to be the Queen City, but when they saw our ship, they changed it to the River Afton. The River Afton was the ship, I think it was the convoy ship. We were very pleased with that because if you are the Commodore ship, you've got to take a hell of a lot of radio messages. I think it was the PQ-13 actually. I've got books on the Arctic convoy. But
it'll be on record anyway, don't worry.
Yeah.
Did you have any problems unloading the cargo in Murmansk?
Yes. The Russian dock workers came pretty soon after we arrived. And they found us a berth, and then they started unloading the aircraft from the tween decks. We soon got those out. And then it was the following day, of it getting what normally would be the evening, round about 7 or 8 p.m., although it's light in those days. At that time of the year, it was only slightly dark, round about midnight. And as you got into May, of course, you had the midnight sun. The crew, most of the crew went ashore, you see, they usually did. They probably went for a glass of lemonade or something like that. And But about an hour after they had gone, the every siren sounded, and I thought, well, we're taking the gunnery course. We had to take a gunnery course to go to sea. All radio officers had to take a gunnery course. Did I mention that before? Yeah. So we thought, well, we'd better see what's going to happen. We went on the bridge. I don't know why, but among the equipment, there was no tin hat for me. They all had tin hats for shrapnel and stuff dropping down. See, anyway, I was assigned to help the army gunner. Was on the port Twin Orlican, you know. And my word, they did fire off some bullets as the aircraft came over, and it was very thirsty for these bullet belts I kept feeding. And there was alongside the docks on the quay, there were these huge storage warehouses. And on top, on the roof of these warehouses were the Russian women. They usually had women machine gunners. And the aircraft apparently were able to come low down round the back of these big warehouses and then turn over the line of shipping, you see. And that's how they got good results with the bombing. But apart from all the ships firing at them and the women firing at them, there were also a ring of bases firing Bofors guns and heavier stuff by the Russians. So the German pilots are very, very brave to come over. And there are usually two or three aircraft brought down every raid. And after about 15 or 20 minutes, it would be, our ship was hit by a stick of three bombs. Well, as far as I can see, the three of it, there might have been two even hit a further ship ahead. I'm not sure if it wasn't the Lancaster Castle. But it was a miracle for us then, because these bombs didn't explode the gunpowder, which was we're very pleased about that. The bomb that hit me, I was involved, it seemed to be sort of a red flash around me. And I was blown violently, and a big whoosh behind me blew this arm up, my left arm out straight. And I'd blown violently into this gun where I'd been helping. The army man who'd been there, he was blown off by the bombs. Very unfortunate fellow, because when they examined him, there wasn't a mark on him. But he was completely insane for the rest of his life. Some people who know me with the silly things I do, they said, you must have been affected as well. But anyhow, my left arm was crumpled about. I knew it was broken. I didn't know whether both bones were broken, but I knew the ulna had gone. And then I was dazed by this, and I was just lying there on the bridge floor, and the second mate comes to me. Is this recording? He said, are you all right, Sparks? They always insisted on calling us Sparks, even though the unit had fought for status as radio officers. That was only so they had to give us a cabin and couldn't stick us in the forecastle. We didn't want people to salute us. Anyway, I said, are you all right, Sparks? I said, yes, I'm all right. See to the others, because I knew some were in a bad way. And then I think I must have passed out, maybe for about 20 minutes or so. And when I come round, I was alone on the blazing ship. And I just couldn't believe that. And then I remembered, well, they did say I was all right. And of course, with the fires, the ship was pretty well ablaze in the midships and towards the stern. And of course, everybody had expected that the gunpowder was going to explode any moment. And they would have had difficulty in getting the injured off to the ambulances. So in all this confusion, you could excuse them leaving a man who said he was all right. Because they would probably think I'd walked off or got off somewhere with the rest of the crew. But I looked around, I saw these machine guns. You can see machine gun fires, you know. In the sequence of four on each machine gun, it's TITA, T-I-T-A. Tracer, incendiary, tracer, armour piercing. where you can see the tracer bullets, and I can see some of them were still firing towards our ship, so I could walk all right. I remember taking a deep breath, I think, oh, thank God that doesn't hurt. So I got some damage to the rib and that, but mostly was the arm's damage. And I went into, while the war was still going on, I had a quick look at the twin Oerlikon gun where I must have damaged it. It seemed all out of line. At first I thought I would do a Jackie Cornwell and he'll fire when he was Indian, you see. And I thought, well, it's a good chance to do something. But as I lined it up, because I couldn't use my left arm to swing on properly, and I saw in the sights those Russian women firing the gun, I thought, oh, hell, I mustn't fire this, it's all out of line and I might kill some of those women. So I just went into a sort of a funk hole. The wheelhouse was always protected by sort of concrete because of the dive bombers. And so I went in there for a bit till things got quieter. And after a few minutes, the raid did break off. We weren't the target anymore, of course, in any case. And then I thought, well, this is not a very healthy place. The ship's fire seemed to be getting worse. So I started to walk down to where the gangplank had been, but that gangway was all blown off to hell. They must have had a job getting the injured off. And I was walking further down towards where the gangplank would have been, and something whisked past my head. I thought, what the hell was that? And then another one, and something went right over there. I looked, there was a round thing, and it dawned on me with horror that those were the metal caps of the gunpowder cylinders, and they were being expelled by heat expansion, I suppose. And so I thought, well, I'd better get off this ship, it's not very good. I couldn't see any way I could get off the ship there, so I went back up to the boat deck. I had a quick look in the radio room, but that was all wrecked. I looked for the secret code books, which had lead covers, so you throw them over the side. But the chief radio must have got in and got them somehow. He was on the bridge with me. I'd been playing him at chess, actually. And so I thought, well, I've no responsibility here now. All the secret material's gone. So I'll try and get off. I looked around and I saw those going under the bridge. There was a mooring rope going to the quayside, you see. I thought, well, I wasn't too bad on ropes when I was a kid, but you had to do it on my right hand, you see. I thought, well, best than blown to bits, I'd better try and get ashore. As I slid down this rope, suddenly I was pitched off. There'd been a sort of a wide junction there I hadn't noticed in my... I was semi-dazed, you see, from the blast and everything. My ears were still ringing from the noise of the gun, and this arm had got very swollen up, and I went head over ears. But luckily I didn't strike myself on the ship or the quayside or any other object in the way down. I went straight into the water. I think that hitting that water with the ice floes, and it was probably one of the biggest shocks I ever had in my life. I was gasping for a long time to try and control my breath. I eventually did do it. Luckily I was wearing a duffel coat, you know, there's a wooden button so your hands don't freeze on them. A duffel coat, and that was as good as a life jacket and kept my head well above the water. And also I was wearing a lot of Arctic underclothing, and that kept the worst of the cold from me. And I managed to get rid of my sea boots, which I thought would be heavy, big heavy welter boots. I thought they would be weighing me down a bit. But after a time I could see that I was going to be in real trouble, because the ship's still likely to blow up any time, and all the onlookers, our would-be helpers, were watching for the ship to explode. They're standing about 600 yards away. And, you know, I thought, well, I'll try and see if I can make any progress, but I couldn't swim with the big ice floes and everything in it. And you needed two good arms to swing and push ice away at the same time. So I thought, well, the best thing I can do is to conserve my energy, to tell you to do that. And I just sort of crouched still. But after a time, I was getting sleepy, and I realised I mustn't fall asleep, because hypothermia does that for you. It makes you sleep so there's no pain, and you just die asleep, you see. And then I thought, well, my mother taught me to say prayers as a youngster, and the Boy Scouts, I went to church, so I said a prayer. And my prayer was answered by a miracle. Only a few minutes later, there was a tremendous hissing of steam, and the associated thing with the fires becoming extinguished. For a long time, I'd been hoping that the ship would sink to the harbour floor so that that would put the fires out, you see. But I watched the rivets, and they weren't moving down at all. I thought, well, the ship isn't sinking. It's no good, Ted. And I said that prayer, and the miracle came, and the ship's fires became extinguished, and it all seemed to be in less than a minute. The rescuers were back. But I was really feeling sleepy, and then I thought, well, I'll just sleep it off, and I was dozing off. And something kept flapping on my head. I thought, well, oh, don't pay any attention. There's no beds around here. And then it kept flap, flap, flap. And then I forced myself to wake up, and I thought it was a big strap, just a flat strap, plain-ended strap. I thought, hell, what do I do with this? And I thought, well, perhaps God was watching me. So I wrapped it twice around my right hand, gripped like hell. I always had a very strong grip in my right hand because electricians are often cutting cables with pliers, you see. So I gripped like hell. This hand couldn't do anything. And I just gave a gentle two-pulse signal, which means up, veer in Arabic and that sort of thing. And it tightened, and I started to pull up, and I gripped like hell. And I must have weighed hell of a lot with all the sodden clothing. But by a miracle, my grip held, and I was pulled safely out to the water and onto the quayside. And there's still the ship, and it hadn't exploded, because now the fire's put out, it probably wouldn't explode. And if I'd been cold in the water, I was 10 times worse on the cold side. You know, if you go swimming in a river or somewhere, when you come out of the water, you feel terribly cold. Well, the Arctic winds on my freezing clothing, oh, no, I started to rattle with shivering, you know. But fortunately, I wasn't left too long like that. And
Who had rescued him?
Sorry?
Who had rescued him?
I think the Russian fireman, and the second mate was in the chain as well. Chain about 4 or 5 men on this long strap, and gradually walked backward and pulled me out. Yes, so I was soon into the ambulance, and I remember I really did start to suffer pain then, not from my arm, but I suffered pain in the tender parts because I was getting frostbite in the tender parts. And then we didn't go to the nearby military hospital or naval hospital, as I thought, and I found out then they were full up. There'd been a bit of an offensive starting, and they were pretty well full of casualties. Besides the shipping, there were some army people there. So we went to a civilian hospital on the outskirts of Murmansk. I was very pleased about this because it meant that we wouldn't have any danger from the air raids. And I was put in the hospital. They just put me on one of these trolleys where they push patients around, you see. And as they pushed me there, I was shivering like blazing. I'm very ashamed of myself to think that I didn't try. I tried hard, but I couldn't stop this shivering and shaking and vibrating and that sort of thing. And I couldn't say to stop it with the cold. It was the thing I just couldn't stop. But I knew that they were working on people that were much more badly injured that needed. In fact, I knew that one of our young apprentices was having one of his legs amputated. And so I didn't want to give the impression I thought I ought to be attended to out of priority, you see. Well, I couldn't stop the shivering, but eventually they did come to me, and they poured me out 3 large tots of vodka, or vodka it is in Russian. And this vodka, I had 3 big shots on that, and within minutes I was on top of the world. I could have started singing. And I was given a bed, and I thought it was quite cold in this ward, but apparently they were used to lower temperatures than we were, and I couldn't sleep because I was quite cold. And then there were two blankets on this thing, but I'm not supposed to do it, but I wrapped myself in the blanket. And then one of the nurses came. She looked at me, seemed quite amused that I was doing this. And then when he explained to her, the Russian word for coal was Holander. I said, Holander. And she looked incredibly at me and said, yeah. And I went, and she went and fetched back two more blankets. So I had four blankets. When most of the other people only had one blanket. That was standard, the Russian people. That was all right. They're quite happy about this. And I remember this same nurse, she looked at me, she was cold, and they didn't have anything like hot water bottles or anything like that, but she saw I was cold. And she went and brought a litre-sized, a big lemonade bottle, and brought that to me, and it was full of water. Apparently, her family weren't supposed to take hot water to the patient, but she gave me a wink. She says, chai, that's the Russian word for tea, you see. And so I was allowed hot tea, you see. And she put it, you know, in, like it was in a hot water bottle. She was very kind to me. And I sort of sawed out back to normal. And the next day, when the Russian nurse came round, she counted up loudly in Russian. I can't say it in foreign. 1, 2, 3, 4 blankets, and they're all laughing at me. I thought, well, I don't mind if you laugh at me, so I can get by and get warm. And then later I thought I could have a walk around, you see. I thought they'll soon stop me. I had to go, though, and they said that in effect, they couldn't plaster it at present because it was swollen or something, you see.
Your arm?
Yeah. So, and the next day, they'd found a Russian who at some time had served on an American ship, and he could speak a bit of English, you see. Up to now, there'd been nobody could speak English. And he said, your arm is a little broken. So far as I know, the ulna, it was a parallel fracture. And they were going to set it a day or two the swelling had gone down, you see, and they plastered that. But they warned me, I got to move it round and put it behind my back and everything, but I could somehow feel there was something grating in the elbow, but I hadn't enough knowledge to realise that the head of the radius was dislocated, you see. I got very little of that. But I didn't know about that, and unfortunately I couldn't tell them about it. But I was able to walk around, and I found in one of the recreation rooms, that more or less a chess room, there's a lot of people playing chess there. But that was my hobby. I was hoping to get into the Yorkshire County team. I probably would have done, but for the war breaking out when the matches were stopped. And they were looking at me and queried, you know, I thought an Englishman, Englishki, doesn't know much about chess. And I was watching this fellow who was showing off and lording over them, you see, and he kept beating them all. And I thought, well, I saw some of his moves that were absolutely anti-theory, and I thought, well, he wouldn't stand last long in a counter match playing that kind of move. So I got permission to give him a game, and I managed to beat him fairly easily. In fact, there were stronger players, I thought, at the whole chess club. But of course, Murmansk wasn't a very big chess centre, actually. It was a fairly big city, but it wasn't one of the big Russian chess centres. But anyway, when I beat him, Dobre comrade, and there was the effect vodka and all sorts of things, that they were so pleased and pat me on the back. And he so tough to this fellow I'd beaten.